This is January the 8th in the year 2001, and this is Bob Gilgore interviewing Mrs. Mary Scroggs at her home in Carroll Woods. Good afternoon, Mary.
Good afternoon.
I appreciate your letting me interview you today. I'd like to start with a little background on you, where you're from, what kind of home you grew up in, what your parents did, where you went to school, and then we'll get into how you arranged to come here to Chapel Hill and get on the school board.
All right, I was born in Nebraska. My father was a dentist. I lived there until I finished college, and then I went to Eastman Kodak Research Labs as a chemist and was there a number of years and was married in Rochester to a native North Carolinian, and he didn't like the climate much and had an opportunity to come back down here and be on the staff at the university, and so we came back here in 1947, and I've been here ever since. So while I'll never be a native, I've got right much time in North Carolina, longer than any place else.
What were your parents like?
Well, you know, I did distinguish them, I guess, from anybody else's parents. They were just there. I was an only child, and so they were probably fairly protective.
So you came here in 47, and did you work? Did you spend your time raising a family?
Well, we had a family fairly promptly then, and I didn't go to work until the twins were, maybe three or four.
And what kind of work did you do?
Well, I put a push paper for the university. There wasn't really any opportunity for color photographic chemists at the university here. Nobody had much interest in the kind of work I'd been doing. And I worked some at journalism, and then I went to physics and ended up being the administrative manager, you know, the prime paper pusher.
And how did you get interested in the school board?
Well, of course, my father had been a member of a school board out there, so I'd grown up with the sort of the Nebraska school law lying where he could always reach it. And I was interested because I had kids in school, and I was interested because I felt there were things that could be done that were different than they were being done. I was on the something called a citizens committee for the schools for a number of years before I ran for the board.
Mm-hmm. What was the citizens committee?
It was a group of people who were interested in schools, black and white, who worried about the things that schools did and didn't and more really didn't do. The school system was not nearly as well financed as it is now. And so there was more of a more opportunity for people to do things in the schools. I mean, you felt more the necessity of doing things in the schools because there weren't many people there. Like the thrift shop got started. That was started by the Art Guild because they thought there ought to be more art taught in the schools, and then it got to be bigger than they could quite manage, and so they got the PTA council to take it over.
What are some of the issues that the citizens committee dealt with besides the raising of money for?
Well, a lot of it was academic. You know, were there going? You know, could you take more than 2 years of Latin? What other foreign languages could be taught? How about more mathematics, you know, this sort of thing? And their interests were a fair amount of them were academic.
What did you consider your biggest accomplishments?
Oh, I don't know that we accomplished much except that we worried about things. So I think we did the thing we worried about a lot, of course, was to try to get better financing, both at the state level and at the county level. We pushed very hard to get the local district tax raised. And there was a time when, in the early days, Carrboro was not in the Chapel Hill Carrboro School District. It was in the county district, but high school students were assigned to Chapel Hill High School, but they didn't have to pay the local district tax. And the school board got its back up and said, you come in and pay the tax, or you go to your high school in Hillsboro. You have a choice. And there was an election, and they voted in, and White Cross didn't. So White Cross is still in the county district.
In looking at the school board minutes, saw that when you came, about the time you came on, the school board, they did increase taxes to raise more money for the schools, but they seem to waffle on that.
Oh, it's a struggle every year about this, even now. I used to spend every time the county commissioners met during budget season, I was in Hillsboro and sat with them. And they would say, we aren't going to discuss schools today, Mrs. Scroggs. And I'd say, all right, but I want you to understand our problems, and so I think I'll stay and listen and understand yours. And except when they went to lunch and I couldn't overhear them, I sort of knew what they were talking about. But we got the ceiling raised on the local district tax. That doesn't mean it's going to get levied, just as it doesn't now. I think we're still under that same ceiling, which I think is 35 cents. But I don't think they've levied more than 18 or so. Because the school boards in North Carolina are fiscally totally dependent
on the local tax.
On the local tax, on the state. You know, big part of the money comes from the state.
So if you come from a poor county, a poor district, you don't have as much money.
No, not nearly. It'll come up in the General Assembly again this year, but it has over the past few years. And the state has been making some appropriations to low-wealth counties to try to even this out some. Counties that essentially don't have much of any tax base.
Farming communities?
Primarily, mostly in the eastern part of it. And some, I suppose, in the mountains, but I think of more as Tyrrell and Pasquotank and Perquimans and some of those counties that don't really have much of any industry of any kind. So that it's a rough go. And some of them could levy more and don't.
So how big was the Citizens Committee?
There must have been 12, 15.
And what kind of representation was there from the African-American community?
Some. Again, the sort of same thing that you see in a lot of other things. They didn't say much. They came, they didn't say much. And I guess the people who got on it were the people who, you know, the squeaky wheels got greased and they got appointed.
And when did you go on the school board?
I never going to remember if it was 60 or 61.
And how long were you on it?
16 years.
That's an elected post.
Yeah.
For 16 years.
When I was on the board, the term was 6 years. But when I the year I was elected, there were 2 sixes in 1 4-year term because Henry Brandis, who had been, or who was then the dean of the law school and was on the board, resigned because he said the Supreme Court had spoken and they better get on with it. And they didn't believe him and he resigned. And then there was an interim appointment, and then the rest of that term came up.
So his resignation was in protest against the school board not acting?
Yeah.
And how much input did he give to the school board to push them?
Oh, he worked valiantly at this, and they just would not be moved. Mm-hmm. And he clearly, you know, he understood what the Supreme Court had said.
And what was his understanding, and what did
he's one of the prime attorneys in all of North Carolina as the dean of the law school. And, you know, he says when the Supreme Court speaks, you listen. And you have an obligation. Now, he doesn't say, you know, you've got to do something instantly. And he was perfectly willing to look at things like all deliberate speed. But he felt they ought to be discussing it and trying to make a move toward doing what he felt was both right and that they were obliged to do.
Now, that was Brown versus the Board of Education.
Yeah,
in
the 54 decision.
And all due speed, when did they start discussing
integration? I don't remember. I don't know if they discussed it much of any. And this was before the days that these things became class actions, so that they were individual parents bringing suit, which from our point of view was a blessing when we started to do it, because we could try something, and if it didn't work, we could back away from it and try something else. And we tried a lot of things.
So what was the tenor of the school board when you became a member?
Well, there was a shift of gears because the three people who were elected that year did think the Supreme Court had spoken.
Who were those people?
Fred Ellis and Dick Peters and I.
So did you vote mainly as a block when it came?
Well, we were together on most things. Now, have you talked to Reverend Manley yet?
Yes.
He was on the board at the time.
Yes.
And Kemp Jones. And Gray Culbreth and Helen Allen. One member from the preceding board didn't run, and one ran and was defeated. I can't remember how we got the third, what the third one came out. But it was, and obviously I got the 4-year term. I ran third, and I came on the board with a real mandate. I beat the next guy out by 2 votes.
That's quite a mandate. Did it change the way you approached your decision making?
No, I think... there were some uncomfortable times when there was a fair amount of disagreement, but there were I don't know how many, it seemed one of them all the time, of sort of town meeting things, you know, school board coming and the group coming, somebody sponsoring a. Sort of, let's question the candidates and see how we want to vote sort of thing. Some of them very large. One at the Chapel Hill High School was standing room only in the auditorium.
So you held a meeting at Chapel Hill High School?
Yeah, the old high school downtown. There was one over at in the North Side community. I went to at least one, maybe two over there.
Tell me about those, what went on at the Chapel Hill High and then what went on.
Well, I think we didn't really know what was happening quite at the Chapel Hill High School one. There were some very pointed questions
What kind of questions?
Well, we had them on both sides. The Quakers felt the Supreme Court had spoken, and they had really organized themselves. And it was not obvious that they had planned a whole series of questions, but they had, and they were well thought out, and they brought out an awful lot of facts. We had Hilliard Caldwell was sitting in the front row, and do you know who Hezekiah Dobson is?
No.
Well, Mr. Dobson was, he may have had something to do with the health department, I don't know. Anyhow, he was a very ardent segregationist, and he sat in the front row. And
not nearly near.
Oh yeah, yeah, oh, really? Right together virtually. And they virtually got into one, and some friend of Hilliard's who was sitting behind him sort of clamped him on the shoulders and didn't let him get up and start a fight. And of course, Hilliard was very, very active in things like public accommodations. He was one of the people who lay in the streets and tried to make a point. We never had that kind of protests about the schools. I think they thought the schools were trying. They did not think that any of the local, particularly heating establishments, were trying.
So did you feel something came out of this meeting of the school board at Chapel Hill High School?
Oh, sure. We voted to send the first black children to the elementary school that night.
And right, well, did you do that in private session or right there?
No, I think we must have. Well, I don't think that would be an allowable thing to do in private session. We had attorneys from Durham representing the black community. They made their speeches.
What year was that?
As I say, it was either 60 or 61.
So the first white children going, the first black children going to white schools were in the...
You know, the first ones in elementary school went to Estes Hills, mm-hmm. where I was very glad that my children also went. And this was in the, we didn't have a plan at that point. So if people applied, the board could consider it. And then we went on to having to see what sort of overall district-wide plan we had to have, which was developed then in the next year, or the first of many plans.
When did the first black students go to the junior high and high school while it was still on Franklin Street?
I don't...
It was later?
Yeah, but not appreciably later. I think, by the next fall when we had a geographic assignment plan. It was a geographic assignment plan with free transfer, and some of the black students who were assigned to the white schools opted to go back to Northside and to Lincoln, and some of the white students who were assigned to Northside, I think all but one maybe, asked to be transferred back to wherever they had come from. And it was very hard and the attendance lines were very much gerrymandered to try to keep some reasonable balance about how many black students went to each school, mostly to protect Carborough, where we figured was where we'd have our problems.
And can you explain that more?
Well, there were a higher percentage of black students who would have been assigned to Carborough, and they, by and large, were not as well educated, and they weren't as well much in favor of this. And I think there was the feeling that we didn't need another Little Rock. And we let the word out that if anybody, when those first black children went to Carborough, looked cross-eyed, we knew where the jail was, and they did too. And we'd have a parent out of there in no time. and we had 40 not visible highway patrolmen in Chapel Hill the morning we sent the first children to Carrboro. We didn't need them, but they were here.
When the first black students went to the all-white schools, how many attended? Was it a handful, or was it a significant number?
By that time, there was a significant number. You know, well, if you look at it, I don't know that there have ever been more than 25% black in the school system here. It's down, I understand, some now. And I think probably a lot of that is because of the cost of housing. They can't afford it.
Was there any preparation given to the black students entering the white school? Was there any?
I don't know. And if we did, we didn't do it very well. It was one of those things that I think we didn't know what to do.
And what about the teachers? Was there a black teacher? Were there black teachers assigned to the white schools?
Oh yeah, all of the black teachers were retained and were assigned somewhere.
So in 61, when integration of elementary school occurred.
Well, of course, it didn't occur for all elementary children at that stage.
It was just Estes Hills.
Estes Hills had the first one, and there were just a handful. So it was, and then by the next year, you know, there were more, and there were but we had the black community is not very evenly distributed in town, and at that point there was no black housing presence in what were white neighborhoods, so that we were dependent on busing to a large extent. And I went one year, well, it was a group that went from the North Carolina School Boards Association, went to Washington to lobby for various and sundry things, and went to Jesse Helms' office, and he was busy presiding in the Senate, and we talked to a couple of his aides who were from New Jersey and didn't really have a clue about what it was like to be in the South. And now he was all hell-bent to introduce legislation to forbid busing, and we said, oh, God, don't do that to us. It's the only way we can make it work. Of course, we were building, at that one time I went on the board, they'd already let a contract for Frank Porter Graham School. It was named at that time. And Dr. Frank's position was that he would be happy to have a school named for him, provided it was a desegregated school, but he wasn't interested in being named, having a school, a segregated school named for him. And I remember going to the dedication of that school, and his portrait was unveiled by R.D. Smith's twin daughters. So that it was what the school board had said, essentially to the black community, is that we were building Chapel Hill High School. That we are now in a position that we could accommodate both high schools in that building. But we want to know that you want to go there. And consequently, we want parents to let us know where they want, what they want to do. We said the one thing we can say to you is when the enrollment, if you choice the enrollment down below a certain point, we will have to go ahead and say you're all going to have to go to the new high school. Because that's the level at which we do not think we can provide a a viable curriculum.
So choicing down meant
they would say
increasing the number who were going to go to Lincoln High School?
Mm-hmm. And they choiced it down below, well below the level that we said. I think they said we had to have a minimum of 75 in the high school. That would be two. And some other number for the junior high, and I've forgotten how many, in order to be able to present any kind of reasonable curriculum.
Was there disagreement in the black community as to what to do with Lincoln High School?
Well, surely I'm sure they wanted to know. Obviously, you don't shift one of those things overnight. When we moved out of Northside, we sent the school administration to Northside, and in the newer of the two buildings that were there, and then it got burned, and I don't think the kids who burned it meant to burn it. They had been busy making Molotov cocktails to throw in other places, and they had one left over, and they went lived up in that neighborhood, and they threw it, and it went through a window, and the building burned. So there we were. And we finished out that school year in a building that just smelled dreadful. It looked awful with black things hanging down the window. And then we moved the administration to Lincoln. And by that time, we were in trouble with our elementary schools being crowded. And so we finally sent all of the the people who lived in the northeast quadrant of Chapel Hill, and I took all the people's names who were on the petitions and looked them up in the phone book and plotted which quadrant they lived in, all thought that Lincoln should become the new junior high. And the people who lived in the southern part of town didn't think so. And so we sent all the sixth graders in the whole school district went to Lincoln, no matter where they lived. And essentially, I've said sort of sometimes, it's one way to do it. And we had a particularly bright young man over there, and he did a fine job. And when we were able then to discontinue this all sixth grade school, which was pretty expensive in transportation, parents didn't want it discontinued. It had been a good thing, and they liked it. And so it was a... But... and then eventually, of course, we disposed of gym and some things over there to the town of Chapel Hill to use for recreation purposes, and used the rest of the building for administration. And we had some classes over there. We had some classes for... seems to me we had a class or two over there for seriously retarded youngsters in self-contained classrooms. I mean, we were short of space.
So the sixth grade junior high school was taught there for what, 1 year,
no,
2 years?
A couple of years at least.
Did the black community, were they solid behind integration, or did some of them want to keep their children at Lincoln and segregated?
Well, some of them did, of course. We had a committee who studied long and hard about the future of Lincoln, and that was... well represented of the black community, particularly of people who had gone there to school. And, you know, some people thought we should just tear it down, and pretty hard up as we were, we couldn't afford to tear down anything. But in the elementary schools had freedom of choice. You could go any school you wanted to. We would transport. Well, that only lasted a year because we couldn't. It was going to take all of our money to transport, because you'd have a block up in which the parents had opted to go to three different elementary schools, and you were sending three buses in to pick up kids in a neighborhood. So that one didn't work. And the board had taken, early on, were interested in trying to maintain racial balance. We felt that this was really important.
So when Estes Hills opened, if I may, my take is that there were significant
not significant numbers, very small numbers.
Initially there were small
very numbers small numbers of children whose parents had requested the transfer.
When you say small numbers, are you talking about
half a dozen? I don't think there were that many. We started out with first graders, the notion being we would do first graders, the next year we'd do first graders and continue the first graders into second grade. Well, that was too slow. We finally decided we needed to get on with this a little faster. But
did you get any feedback on how these children felt, from them or from their parents, to have such a small number of African Americans in a white school?
No, I don't remember hearing anything. The parents who, of course, made this request felt very strongly that they wanted their children to go to a school that had both white and black students in it, so that they were prepared to make the best of it, I guess, even if it had some disadvantages.
Let's go back to the school board, and I don't want to repeat myself, but in a way, maybe I've asked this question, but I'd like to revisit. When you got on the school board, what was the tenor of the thinking of the school board? Was it, let's push ahead with integration, or was it, let's continue to drag our feet?
No, I think by the time I got on the board, there was a majority that felt that the foot-dragging days were pretty much over. And that we needed to begin to make some sort of moves that were going to accomplish what we thought was expected of us. And I think there was a very strong feeling, probably on all of the board, no matter how they felt about desegregation, is that we wanted to do it ourselves. We did not want to have this come in and a judge under court order tell us how to do it.
Were financial considerations part of the stimulus for...
No, we were so poor in that. That was the year that we didn't have... that the school was in... actually had run a deficit, which is illegal. And we didn't have enough money to pay the teacher supplements. And finally, you know, we put on a fund drive and asked people to contribute. And we got enough money to pay the supplements to all of the teachers who had signed on to come back the next year. And those who hadn't got a little bit, but not a full supplement. So that we were in real financial difficulty. And this was just one more thing that could have been expensive.
Is that when you decided to ask the county to increase the...
I don't remember the dates on that. We asked for more money every year, and that was how it went. And we presented them with what we thought was a reasonable budget, and this was how it was, and we gave them an income statement and a proposed outlay, and the county board at that time presented them three pieces of paper: what they wanted in current expense, what they wanted in capital outlay, and what they wanted for buses. Didn't say where the money was going to come from, didn't tell how much they had left over. this sort of forced their hand and they had expand their budget presentations.
Now, at that time, in 61, when you went on the school board, how many school board members were there?
Seven.
And there was one member of the school board who was African-American, that was Reverend J.R. Mann.
Right. Yeah.
What role did he play in the school board? Was he a real activist, or?
Well, he was that, and the other thing is that he brought to the board the thing, the only one who brought to the board sort of the feelings that he got in the black community of how people were feeling and what their aspirations were, if you were. His wife taught at Northside.
So he, it was a real advantage to have.
Oh yeah, far and away. And he was the first black who'd ever been elected to the board. Now whether, I don't, my history doesn't go back to how, when the board was appointed, so I don't know whether there were any black members on it or not. But he was certainly the black. And he may well have led the ticket when he ran. I think people recognized that there certainly needed to be representation and were quite willing. And then there was a while when there wasn't a black member. And then we had a resignation, and I guess that's when Ed Caldwell was appointed, because I remember we were meeting over at Northside. And we decided this is what we wanted to do, and several of us walked over to his house and asked him, because he lived over there, whether he would be willing to serve. I had known his mother, and of course his aunt, Frances, was one of the early black teachers in a formerly white school. She had taught at Northside, and then I think it was the Junior Service League, but I'm not positive of that, who financed her going off and studying more to be a teacher of handicapped children. And she taught at, I know she taught in Carborough. She would be an excellent person for you to interview.
I think I have her lined up. Thank you.
But I had gotten acquainted with her. I had gone to a sewing class up at the Northside School, and she was in it, and so was her sister, who was Ed's mother. We had labored over learning to sew things that we hadn't known how to sew before.
The junior high school, I understand, was integrated a couple years after Estes Hills, and I've interviewed.
Yeah, probably, and I don't know that I have a good timeline on that anymore. It's been a long time. And at that point we had junior high schools as opposed to middle schools as they have now.
Now, I've interviewed some of the people who were the first to go to the junior high school, first blacks to go to the junior high school. And the kind of comments that I get back was it was like being on an island.
I would think that might be a very good description of it. I think they felt isolated. And had I been in their shoes, I'd have felt isolated. There were problems that people brought up, you know, the first junior-senior prom at the high school, once it was desegregated. Would we allow blacks and whites to dance together? This is the level at which people's concerns could be felt. You know, our feeling was sort of we guessed if they wanted to, you know. But it was uncomfortable. Probably one of the best things that has happened are the number of youngsters who got involved in athletics, because the football team has always had both white and black students. And I think the basketball team has as well. I don't know that any blacks have ever played soccer. It doesn't seem to appeal. The girls basketball team, always both black and white students. And it's one of the things that kept many black students in school because they wanted to play and they had to keep their grades up or they wouldn't be eligible.
I'm not trying to indict the school board at all. I'm trying to learn what their role was. So, my question is, what role did the school board have in preparing the black students who were going to the white schools, and what kind of feedback were they getting? And was it their charge to do that?
Well, I don't know whether it was their charge, and I don't know how well we did it, and I don't think we knew what to do. We did not get any appreciable feedback from black students or black parents. I had kids in, well, I guess in the junior and senior high schools, and maybe I still had kids in elementary school who, at the time of these things. There was a voiced thing from many black students who didn't really want to try to excel academically because that made them whiteies. And to some extent that is still true.
How did you pick that up?
They said it. Maybe not to the school board, but to the children and school board members. Heard it all the time because they were there.
So they did not want to assimilate into white society?
No, not really.
Yet education was stressed in the black community tremendously, what I hear.
Particularly from mothers. I don't know that much from black fathers, but the black women, many of them had been domestics in white households, and they saw how different things could be. They learned more about nutrition because you did something more than put on a pot of pinto beans. They got that white children had books and they read, that there were newspapers and there were magazines and there were this sort of thing that they didn't have. And so I think among the black women, and it's been a matriarchal society by and large, I gather, not just here. They wanted something for their children.
So they brought that home.
They brought that culture home. Some of it home and tried to instill some of it. But neither could they afford the things that even then a relatively affluent white community could do. You know, if your children wanted a book, my damn, you couldn't get down to the Intimate fast enough to buy it. And they were not in the position to do that. So that there was, that's part of the trouble still. There are not very many black homes that are going to have encyclopedias, and they'll have TVs, but books or magazines or daily paper just aren't there. And in those days, and I don't know how it is now, no place for a youngster to really sit down and do homework. There were little brothers and sisters and bigger brothers and sisters and lots going on, and a mother who came in late and then had to get a meal on the table. And there were efforts made to find places that students could go and do homework. The Northside Community Center tried to make this available, and even with people who came and helped with homework, and it was only modestly successful. But it was, so it was and there's been, as long as I can remember, and certainly continues to be now, What can you do to try to improve the achievement of the black student? And the school board here has put out huge amounts of money and tremendous amounts of effort. There was the Blue Ribbon Committee that worked on this. Mark Royster was the chairman of that committee. And it's continued, and they set a whole set of goals of things that they wanted to do and how they might. And they've been trying to do that, and now this coalition of school boards from what, a dozen or so communities over the country that are trying to combine what they've learned in ways to improve things. Many of them communities where there is a fairly dominant university or college, they've got some of that backing, but how to, you know, we tried this and it worked, or we tried this and it didn't work. And so Chapel Hill, Carrboro has representation on that. I think the Sheriff Mack, who's the principal at Sewell, is one of those. They have students who've gone and came back and had suggestions. And the test scores have gone up, but they haven't gone up as much as the would like. They've probably gone up maybe at a slightly faster rate than the ones for white students. But if you have a school system where the average SAT score among